It's Current State on 90.5 WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. April is Autism Awareness Month. Autism is a condition that's much examined by the medical community, but still elusive in its causes and treatments. Here with us now to look at the history of the condition is Dr. Jeffrey Baker. Dr. Baker's a pediatrician and medical historian, and last fall he wrote a historical perspective on autism that was published in the New England Journal of Medicine. Dr. Baker, welcome to Current State.
Good morning, Mark.
First of all, help us with just the basic terminology here. We people talk about autism. We also hear about autism spectrum disorder. Help us understand these phrases.
Sure. Well, autism, for most of my professional career, has been defined in terms of a triad of really involving three different domains. The first is an impaired ability to relate to other people. The second domain is either absent language or atypical language, you know, characterized, for example, by echolalia, by repeating phrases, by using language, by just repeating language instead of using it to communicate. And the third domain would be what is called rigid and repetitive behaviors. Children with autism have unusual attachments to objects. They may like to do the same things over and over and typically don't have a lot of imaginative play. So that's kind of classic autism. In the 70s and 80s, the term used to be just reserved for very children who are very severely afflicted. It was a very rare condition. Then it was recognized that autism is really more of a continuum. For example, the label of Asperger's syndrome came in. That was a term used to designate people who have normal language, normal intelligence, or at least normal functional language, but can't use, but still have difficulty conversing, tend to converse in a one-sided kind of way, or maybe have difficulties with the give and take of normal conversation. Another label that will be well known to people in the autism community is sometimes known as PDD for short, stands for Pervasive Developmental Disorder, not otherwise specified. And this is a term that's been used to refer to children with milder degrees of autism. Maybe if you think of classic autism as suggesting a complete inability to relate to other people, there are some kids who might respond to other people, but not initiate engagement. There might be other kids who want to engage with others, but don't know how. So in the course of the 80s and 90s, you had these other labels circulating more and more, Asperger's, PDD, NOS. And most recently, the DSM-5, the decision was made to group them all together, that drawing the boundaries between these labels was very problematic. So with DSM-5, we have one category, just called autism spectrum disorder, that embraces all of these.
This is a condition that's had a name for at least 70 years or thereabouts. Can you take us back to who was considered the discoverer of this disorder and what they thought it was?
Yeah, so autism, unlike a lot of diseases, really has a birthday. It was described, it really appears quite suddenly on the medical scene with a paper by a Johns Hopkins psychiatrist named Leo Kanner, who in this 1943 paper described 11 children with what he believed was a distinct and never-before-described syndrome. And you can still read these case descriptions today, and they're quite vivid. But they all shared what he called a profound inability to relate to others. And instead, these kids seemed to relate to objects. People kind of scared them, but objects they loved to do the same things over and over, and to routines. Strikingly, he thought that they all had normal intelligence. That the first kids were described with pictures more like the picture we might be familiar with on Rain Man. So it's a very distinct and categorical kind of description that Kanner produced in the 1940s.
It's interesting. We understand that originally autism was thought to be caused by, quote, cold or withdrawn mothers.
Right. Well, it's almost true. So Kanner wrote that the characteristics of the parents in his population were almost as distinct as those of the children themselves. A huge number of his parents had advanced degrees, many in the sciences, and he said that they were tended to be highly intelligent, often in an abstract kind of way. Now, Dr. Kanner actually focused more on fathers than he did on mothers. But psychoanalysts who were gaining tremendous power in American culture in the 40s and 50s, took Connor's observations, flipped them around, and instead said, no, it's the mother. And psychoanalysts argued that what autism really was the response of an infant to a cold, unfeeling, even though perhaps very intelligent, mother. It was infant's withdrawal in response to this kind of mother. This became known popularly as the refrigerator mother era.
Oh, my gosh.
It even seems that Dr. Connor was never quite sure about this. He vacillated between whether this was a effect of dynamics or whether it was a genetic correlation. And as I said, he tended to focus more on the fathers and whether there was some kind of connection of continuity of these kids' genetic makeup. But you can think of the 1940s, 50s, and 60s as being just a dark age of autism, a terrible, terrible period for parents.
We're discussing autism with Dr. Jeffrey Baker. Dr. Baker's a pediatrician and medical historian here, and April is Autism Awareness Month. When did cases of autism start to really noticeably increase?
Well, I think you'd have to say the 1980s, but it all began in the 1980s. Now, we should make clear that the refrigerator mother era went away, so by the time you get to the 70s, autism is being redefined as biologic, and there's more and more interest in genetics. But I think for our sake, as autism was redefined in the 70s and the DSM, the psychiatric manuals, first gave it clear-cut definitions, it was still considered to be very rare and categorical by and large.
Mm-hmm.
One epidemiologic survey in the late 1960s suggested an incidence of about 2 in 10,000, which is quite a contrast with most recent estimates of the CDC. Which, to put it, the most recent is saying 1 in 68, I believe. So what's gone on there? I think everyone agrees, there's widespread agreement that autism is being diagnosed much, much more. There is also widespread consensus that much of this rise is fueled by social and definitional factors. For example, the expansion of the definition, what I've already alluded to, the addition of Asperger's and PDD to describe the milder cases.
Right.
That's clearly part of what's going on. Just the fact that we have much better early intervention systems seeking to detect these kids. We have better services giving parents an incentive to obtain services. Autism, I think, over time became a diagnosis with much less stigma than mental retardation. you see a shift of kids without the diagnosis into autism as well. All this plus public awareness, all these things came together and certainly have contributed to the rise of the diagnosis of autism.
Continue, please.
I was just going to say, what we don't know is whether or not this explains the entire rise. And the best work, which has been done in California, trying to look at the rise in cases there, has been able to account for at least half of the rise with these kind of factors I've alluded to, but still leaves unexplained quite a bit of the rise. So I think we all need to have a bit of humility about just what is going on here. There still may well be a prenatal influence.
Or
some kind of environmental exposure.
Hmm. A recent article in The Atlantic suggested that earlier treatment of autism is better, but that then the potential for misdiagnosing kids who are just slow developers also goes way up. That sounds like a huge challenge.
It is. Now, I guess the same point could be made of almost any early intervention. Early intervention for there are kids who truly have language disorders who will be picked up with early intervention, and then there's some kids who are just late talkers who will speak normally on their own. We clearly do need to do more work on trying to find what predicts a child who's going to do well long-term, who's going to recover on their own versus those who need intervention. But I think it's still unemphasized at this point in time, our best bet for making a big impact on autism is to find these kids early. What you do in that year while you're waiting is profoundly important. And if you don't do anything, some of those kids who are not talking will maybe simply be put in front of a TV screen, and their symptoms will get worse. So I think at this point we do need to emphasize early intervention as our best tool.
One side story here to this larger topic is the issue of parents who believe that certain vaccines caused autism. And that could be another show in itself. But just briefly, if you could tell us what's happened there and how that's affected the discussion.
Well, as autism cases rose in the 1990s, I think you'd find different groups of parents and professionals responded in different ways. Many mainline researchers in academic institutions believe that the rise was just what they expected all along, as the definition was being expanded and they're looking for cases more intensively. But to many parents in the community, it just seemed that there were just far too many cases, that there really was a rise. And it was parents who especially coined the term, parents, I should say, allied with what I might call the more dissident practitioners, who coined the term autism epidemic. And they, in turn, tended to focus on vaccines. We probably don't have time to go into the specific vaccine controversies. One focused on MMR and one on the presence of a preservative containing mercury. Both of those, I think, I've just acknowledged that I think it's quite possible that something environmental may be going on with the rise in autism. I think it's a false dichotomy to say that autism is either all, that the rise is either all definition or it's vaccines. There's a third possibility, which is that there's something else environmental going on, maybe more at the prenatal level. And I do think at this point that the one possible environmental exposure that we can say has really been exhaustively researched is actually that of vaccines. And the evidence really has not supported any role.
So this is interesting. So there's a spectrum in terms not only of the disorder itself and how it manifests itself, but in terms of causation as well.
I think increasingly we are moving toward a model that there's probably some kind of genetic predisposition. We know identical twins are much more likely to both be affected with autism than fraternal twins. But there's still something else going on. And I think there's still a lot of interest in looking at the prenatal period and looking at some other factor that could explain that, you know, what causes certain genetically predisposed kids to actually develop autism.
Is there a discovery or a factor that the medical world feels would really substantively move treatment or prevention options forward here?
I think the medical world is looking hard for those kind of interventions. I think there's a lot of interest in trying to better understand different subtypes of autism, and maybe some of those could be matched with more of a specific treatment. But so far, specific treatments, medical treatments, have proven very elusive. Our best bet at this point is more intensive behavioral intervention directed at young children.
This has been a very enlightening discussion. We really appreciate it. Dr. Jeffrey Baker is a pediatrician and medical historian. We've been discussing autism. April is Autism Awareness Month. Dr. Baker, thank you.
Thank you, Mark.